house. It was said over the phone because he and I were in, Missouri. Arias said the ex-tenant was a really big guy, but added, he doesn't seem violent. He seemed pretty gentle, like a little bit thuggish. What about any of his neighbors? Any problems with anybody? Flores posed. Arias had one neighbor in mind, someone Travis had told her about, although she claimed she didn't know the guy personally. According to Arias, Travis had said, he hates me, and when Arias asked him why, Travis's response was, I think he's jealous because he's a 40-something-year-old that has to go to work every morning, and I'm a successful 20-something-year-old that stays all day in my pajamas at home. This is more than jealousy. This is something else, Flores said of Travis's death. He asked Arias if she had any questions for him, and she listed several. Do you know when all this happened? She wanted to know. You said that maybe multiple people because he was a guy. Maybe you can talk about this, but was there, like, any kind of weapons used? Was there a gun? The weapons used in the attack had not been made public yet, so it immediately struck me that she knew to ask about a gun. I can't say what type of weapon was used, Flores told her, but yeah, I'm guessing there was a weapon used by the type of injuries that were left behind. Do you know if he had any weapons in the house?
His two fists, Arias replied flatly, denying that he had any weapons.
That's it? No handguns or rifles?
No, he wasn't one to keep any of that.
Arias described Travis's interest in wrestling and the UFC and recalled that he liked beating the crap out of his punching bag, seemingly implying that he was given to physical violence. At the time, it was easy to see this characterization of Travis as being physically imposing as just an additional detail in the growing portrait of him. But in the months and years ahead, I often found myself returning to this initial call and thinking about how even then she was attempting to portray herself as a victim by claiming that Travis had a bad temper, as shown by the mean electronic correspondence he had sent her. It didn't matter that she hadn't been implicated. She was already laying the groundwork for her ultimate defense in her first conversation with police. As I would soon learn, Arias seemed to always be thinking several steps beyond her current story. Chapter 3. Over the next 3 days, Detective Flores called me frequently as he and the other investigators continued to process the crime scene and uncover new, disturbing details in the process. His updates weren't meant to seek my guidance, but to keep me informed so that I would be prepared to make a decision on the charges to be filed once the person or persons who killed Travis came to light. While there was still no definitive suspect, Jody Arias was on a very short list of one. Flores told me the killing had been much more violent than the initial scene had suggested. There had been many more stab wounds than what we'd been able to see as we bent over to look at Travis while he lay crumpled inside the shower. Investigators from the Maricopa County Office of the Medical Examiner had unfolded the body to find multiple wounds to the upper back and several more to the torso. They also discovered that the gash to Travis's neck was much deeper than we had originally believed, and they noticed for the first time that he had been shot in the right temple, providing an answer to the empty shell casing found lying in front of the sink, resting in Travis's blood. The doctor conducting the autopsy, Dr. Kevin Horn, would later report that Travis Alexander received 3 mortal wounds, each of which alone would have caused his death. A stab wound near the heart, the slice to the throat, and the gunshot to the right temple. In his opinion, Travis was stabbed first in the chest, with the knife cutting into the protective sac around the heart and perforating the superior vena cava, a major vein that comes down from the head and the upper body, draining into the heart. This stab wound did not cause Travis to lapse into unconsciousness immediately,
and he would have been able to move about for a few minutes before he eventually died. Travis received many defensive injuries to his left hand and one to the right, proving he survived and was conscious long enough to either grab the knife blade or raise his hands to protect himself. According to the medical examiner, Travis's throat was then slashed, cutting the jugular vein and carotid artery as the knife was pulled from one side of his neck to the other. The cut also severed his windpipe, preventing him from screaming or calling for help. It was approximately 3 to 4 inches deep, reaching all the way back to his spine. This wound would have been rapidly fatal, and Travis would have lapsed into unconsciousness within a few seconds of its infliction. Although Travis was still alive when his throat was slashed, he would not have been able to make any voluntary movements, such as putting up his hands after the wound was inflicted. The medical examiner also found that the last fatal injury was the gunshot wound to the right temple, which perforated the brain and came to rest in Travis's left cheek. The doctor could not determine how far away the gun was when the shot was fired, but he could say that the shot would have caused Travis to lose consciousness almost immediately, and he would not have been able to engage in purposeful activity to defend himself. These details from the medical examiner proved helpful in understanding how the actual crime unfolded, a picture that would become even more clear through the blood spatter analysis of Lisa Perry of the Mesa Police Department. Perry's opinion was that the source of the blood, Travis Alexander, had stood over the sink with blood falling onto the vanity. And while he stood there, force was applied to his body, causing the blood spatter patterns on the mirror. She also determined that Travis had already bled on the floor when the shot rang out, because the casing landed on top of blood that had been previously deposited near the sink. Based on the autopsy and the blood spatter analysis, the attack started with Travis being stabbed in the chest while he was still in the shower, and continued with the assailant stabbing him in the back repeatedly as he stood over the sink, causing the blood misting on the mirror. The attack moved to the end of the hallway at the door breach to the bedroom, where Travis's throat was slit, as shown by the large ovoid stain on the carpet. His body was then dragged back to the sink area, as corroborated by the contusions to the right leg, which were consistent with the body being dragged. The casing near the sink indicated that Travis had been shot in the face in that area before his body was put back in the shower. About a week into the investigation, Flores called my office with some curious news. Arias had traveled more than 1,000 miles, 15 hours on the road, from Northern California to Mesa on June 17th to provide biological swabs for use in DNA testing and to provide fingerprint samples. Given Arias's claim that she hadn't seen Travis since April, it was unusual that she would volunteer to drive that distance to give her fingerprints and her DNA to the police. "This woman is calling us, coming out to see us, so clearly she doesn't think she is a suspect," Flores told me. "But we don't know anybody else who would want to kill Travis Alexander except for her." She claimed to have an alibi, that she wasn't even in Mesa at the time of the killing, but the investigation had no other leads and had uncovered no other enemies among Travis's business contacts or friends. Her behavior struck us as odd, but all we could do was speculate. Maybe she believed that police would be less inclined to investigate her because she was so willing to assist us. At this point, there was still no case against her, and no way to identify her as the killer. Each time Flores and I spoke, our discussions about Arias were akin to a catchy song that you can't seem to get out of your head. You sing the same lyrics and hum the identical tune. So it was with our conversations every time he called. We always agreed that it was Arias who killed Travis, we just couldn't prove it. All that began to change on June 19th, when I got a phone call from Flores. I heard the eagerness in his voice and I knew he had something important to tell me. The crime lab had managed to retrieve photographs contained in the memory card of the Sanyo camera that had been found in the washing machine at Travis's house. You're not going to believe this, Detective Flores said with unusual excitement. There are pictures of Arias naked at Travis Alexander's house on June 4th. So she was there. How did you guys get them? I asked. It seemed too good to be true. They were deleted, but we got them, he said. He explained that although they had been deleted, a detective had been able to recover the photos from the unallocated space of the memory card. Police believed that someone had really wanted these photos permanently gone because they had taken 5 separate, deliberate steps to erase them. Detective Flores started to describe the photographs to me over the telephone, but given that they placed our only suspect at the crime scene, I was anxious to see them for myself. So Flores offered to drive the 30 miles from the Mesa Police Department to my office. When he arrived, he already had the copies neatly arranged and separated into 3 groups in a blue 3-ring binder, which he placed on my desk and opened to the first page. All but a small number of the photographs could be proven to have been taken on June 4, 2008. The initial photograph in the first group, which was snapped at 1:42:53 p.m., placed Jodi Arias in Travis's bedroom on the afternoon of June 4th, although she had denied being there no more recently than April. In this photo, Arias was lying naked on Travis Alexander's bed, her arms outstretched and her right leg bent at the knee, exposing the area between her legs. In the lower right-hand corner of that picture, barely visible, appears to be a knee, so police knew Travis must have been the photographer. Arias's hair was in pigtails, one resting just above her left breast. She was not looking directly at the camera, posing seductively with her head turned slightly to the right. Flores and I had a hard time believing that the person we suspected of killing Travis had apparently had sex with him that same day. Flores then showed me the other 5 photographs that had been taken during the same afternoon session. One, snapped at 1:44 p.m., was a close-up shot of Arias's anal and vaginal areas. Another, taken by Arias 50 seconds later, showed Travis naked and on his back, exhibiting his erect penis. In the foreground of that photograph was a bottle of KY personal lubricant. This photo confirmed that the other participant in the sexual activity that day was indeed Travis. There was now no disputing that Arias had been there on the day of the murder, contrary to her protestations to Detective Flores during their June 10th phone call. A 4th photo, taken at 1:47:14, was also of Travis. He was on his back and looking at the camera with his right arm extended, as if motioning Arias to come over to him. The personal lubricant had been moved so that it was now closer to the head of the bed. The next photo, which did not have a timestamp, showed Arias propped up on her elbows, turning her body to the camera as if to show off her breasts and vaginal area, her left pigtail cascading over her shoulder onto the bed, the right one lying between her breasts. The last of these 6 pictures showed Arias's legs spread to display her pubic area. It appeared she had either waxed or shaved in the recent past. Clearly, the couple was captivated by the moments now captured by the camera. I can't say that I was shocked by the photos as I looked at them. Sexual picture-taking has become a commonplace activity these days, especially with the advent of smartphones, all of which are equipped with cameras. And it didn't surprise me that there was a sexual component to this killing. It seems the majority of the homicides that pass across my desk have some sexual element to them. If it isn't about sex, it is usually about money. What was unexpected here was seeing Travis and Arias engaged in sexual activity because they both practiced the Mormon faith, a religion that prohibits any type of sex before marriage. In all of these photos, Arias appeared extremely uninhibited in her poses, and seemed very relaxed in front of the camera, indicating that perhaps she had engaged in this type of sexual foreplay in the past, perhaps even with Travis. But to me, the lasting impression of these pictures had little to do with the explicit nudity they portrayed. What struck me as significant was that Travis was lying in his bed, a place of obvious emotional comfort, only a few short hours before he was bathed in his own blood. As I was about to see, there was a tranquil lull that was documented in the second group of photographs. There were 20 in all, featuring a nude Travis Alexander in the shower. The first was snapped at 5:22:24 p.m., and the last one was taken 8 minutes and 6 seconds later at 5:30:30 p.m. All had been similarly deleted, but not permanently erased. The first 16 captured him standing in the shower, water cascading down his head and body. The last 4 were of him sitting on the shower floor. The first of these was snapped at 5:28:54 p.m. His solemn expression and the way the water was cascading down his cheeks gave the appearance that he was crying. The last one, taken at 5:30:30 p.m., is the last picture of Travis Alexander alive. Approximately 45 seconds later, the killer, who we now believed was Arius, began her assault, as indicated in the final set of deleted photographs. These included 3 images that had been taken inadvertently. 2 of the 3 had been snapped when the camera had been upside down and had appeared dark when first viewed. The detective had enhanced them until he saw Travis's body in each of these photographs. These images were pivotal because they showed someone dragging the body down the hallway as the attack was coming to an end. Suddenly, the events of the crime weren't conjecture, because police could see what had happened at these 2 distinctive moments. The first photo in this set of 3 was time-stamped at 5:31:14 p.m. It was blurry, but one could see the bathroom ceiling above the shower. It did not show either Travis or the person attacking him, and Detective Flores and I agreed that it had been taken either immediately before or during the first part of the stabbing. The second photo was snapped 1 minute and 2 seconds later at 5:32:16 p.m. Travis was on his back in this one. He was at the threshold between the bathroom hallway and the master bedroom, with his head on the carpet and his feet on the tile. His throat had already been slashed, and his head was partially elevated. There was blood flowing from the right side of his neck onto his upper back, spilling onto the tile floor and the edge of the carpet. This accounted for the large amount of blood I had seen on the carpet area during my walkthrough of the crime scene. The person whose stocking foot is in the foreground looked to be grabbing or lifting Travis's right arm. There was a stripe running down the side of the person's pant leg. I asked Detective Flores if investigators had found any pants at the crime scene resembling those in the photograph, but they had not located any clothing like this. Detective Flores then showed me the last of the 3 pictures of this set, which was taken 1 minute and 16 seconds later at 5:33:32 p.m. In this one, the killer is seen dragging Travis back along the hallway toward the bathroom, blood rolling down his back. This last picture in the sequence was inadvertently snapped as Arius dragged Travis's body to the sink area, the place where she put a bullet in his head before continuing to drag him to the shower so that she could stuff his body into the stand-up stall. But this also marked the beginning of her cleanup at the scene, which included the rinsing of the body and deleting the photographs. The cover-up also included taking the plastic tumbler and throwing water down the hallway. It appeared Arius cleaned her feet at some point to avoid tracking any blood and took the bedding and camera downstairs to put them in the washing machine. As Flores turned the last page in the binder, we pieced together the day's chronology based on the timestamps. The police now had evidence that she had spent the early afternoon of June 4th enjoying a sexual dalliance with Travis, followed by a photographic session in the shower later in the afternoon, after which she killed him. It was Detective Flores's and my belief that Arius lured Travis into the shower to entice him into a vulnerable position, naked and defenseless. His shower ended with her stabbing him, slicing his throat, and shooting him. Although Arius had denied being in Mesa within the last couple of months, the photographs proved otherwise. Not only could we place her at the crime scene on the day of the murder, we had a virtual flipbook of the crime itself, a series of images that showed how the events actually played out in the form of time-stamped photographs. Though there was no photo of Arius's face, it was obvious that she was the one dragging him back toward the bathroom when the second inadvertent photograph showing her stocking foot and pant leg was snapped. Based solely on the pictures, I was leaning toward charging Arius with first-degree murder, but I hesitated. While the photos supported our belief that Arius had been with Travis on the afternoon of his killing and provided the story of how his life ended, they still didn't prove that she hadn't walked out before Travis was killed. How can we be absolutely certain that Arius didn't leave the house in between the photos time-stamped earlier in the afternoon and when Travis was killed? I asked. We don't know, Flores answered. We'll have to wait for the fingerprint results to come back. Referring to a latent palm print found in blood on the wall in the hallway leading to the bathroom. I put a rush on the request. That meant I'd still have to wait a little longer to charge her. As Flores packed up the binder, I found myself thinking over the disturbing implications of what the photos had shown. It now seemed clear that Arius's apparent cooperation with police was nothing more than a ruse to divert suspicion away from her. Detective Flores smiled wryly as he reminded me of their telephone conversation on June 10th, where she had offered to help him with the investigation. She had played the part of the grieving ex-girlfriend well. Chapter 4. The police might have had a collection of incriminating photos and an actual timeline of the crime itself, but they were only beginning to build the case against Jodi Arius. While the photographs from the camera were significant, certainly the most significant piece of evidence against her, police still had to proceed cautiously when speaking to Arius, whether it be in person or by telephone. They had to be strategic about what information to share with her. Arius continued to maintain that the last time she'd visited Travis Alexander was in April 2008, 2 months before his murder. Backing up this assertion was a complex yet well-thought-out alibi in which she claimed that on the day of the killing, she was traveling to visit a prospective beau in Utah. In a phone conversation with Detective Flores on June 25th, she laid out the details of her supposed alibi, saying that she left Yreka on June 2nd and had expected to arrive in the Salt Lake City area on the morning of June 4th. For a prepaid legal conference and to spend some time with a potential love interest. She then detailed a night-long escapade of driving in the wrong direction on various highways after getting lost. The errant path taken explained why she arrived a day late on June 5th. When contacted by police, the boyfriend-in-waiting, a man named Ryan Burns, confirmed that Arius had not shown up in Utah until the 5th day of June, a day later than she had told him to expect her. He could not account for her whereabouts in the days leading up to June 5th. Arius's alibi continued to unravel from there. A fingerprint examiner with the Mesa Police Department confirmed on June 26th that the bloody latent palm print found on the west wall of the bathroom hallway belonged to Arius. The palm print put Arius in the hallway near the area where one of the inadvertent photographs captured the body being dragged. But it only proved that Arius was there at some point. It didn't tell us when. The latent print results moved me one step closer to filing criminal charges, but I still wanted to wait for the results of any DNA testing from the scene. Helpful as they are, latent prints are limited in their use because they cannot be dated, and examiners are unable to pinpoint the day a print may have been left. They make a strong case as supporting evidence, but taken alone, the palm print couldn't place Arius at the crime scene while the killing was taking place. Only the DNA results could do that by confirming whether or not Arius had left any blood behind. A week later, on July 3rd, the DNA results from the bloody left palm print showed there was a mixture of DNA from two individuals, Travis Alexander and Jody Arius. There were also DNA results from a strand of hair that was found attached to the wall with blood. It, too, was from Jody Arius. Like latent prints, the hair's presence was not enough to tell us when it was left at the house or how it ended up becoming stuck in his hallway. Arius had been to the house many times, so the hair could conceivably have been left there and only disturbed and attached to the wall later during the attack. The combination of the latent prints, the DNA, and most importantly, the photos, made me feel it was finally appropriate to charge her. The pictures chronicled the couple's activities during the entire afternoon, starting in the bedroom, followed by Travis taking a shower, and ending with the inadvertent photographs of the body being dragged. This timeline from the camera made it clear that both the palm print and hair were left during the attack as Arius stabbed and shot Travis. Although I had palm print and DNA results, the importance of the camera was hard to overstate. If Arius had simply taken the camera from the crime scene and disposed of it on the drive to Utah instead of leaving it behind after deleting the incriminating photographs, I might never have charged her with the murder, because the remaining evidence would not have been enough to prove her guilty at a trial. It was hard to understand what caused Arius to put the camera in the washing machine rather than take it with her. The effort she put into staging the scene was difficult to reconcile with the apparent carelessness of leaving the camera behind. Perhaps she mistakenly believed that once the photographs were deleted, they could never be recovered. Or maybe she was confident that the deletion of the photos, combined with putting the camera through the wash cycle, would erase the images on the camera's memory card. Her reasons for leaving it behind were of little consequence. What was important was that her mistake allowed police to place her at the scene, even though she vehemently denied it. During the June 25th phone call, Detective Flores had let Arius know that police had found Travis's camera in the washing machine, but led her to believe that they had been unable to recover any of the photographs on the memory card, telling her the camera was completely destroyed. In response, Arius boasted of being a photographer and claimed that Travis had sought out her advice before purchasing this Sanyo camera. She then offered the detective solace by advising him that he might consider sending the camera to outside data recovery services that had been successful in retrieving data in situations like this, where it seemed impossible. Whatever her motivation in providing the detective this advice, it seemed she had been undermined by her own arrogance and the mistaken belief that because she had put the camera through the wash cycle, the water and bleach would destroy the images, leaving her safe from scrutiny. Police discovered the remaining part of Arius's cover-up plan in the penumbras of her electronic communications. Within days of the murder, she made a cell phone call, sent a text message, and delivered an email to Travis in an attempt to show that she had nothing to do with his death. She left a voicemail on his cell phone around midnight on June 4, 2008, detailing the same story about getting lost on her way to Utah that she would tell Flores after her arrest in Yreka. "Hey, what's going on? It's almost midnight anyway, right about the time you're starting to gear up. I know Leslie called you, so I already talked to her, so you could call her back if you want. But it's not really necessary. My phone died, so I wasn't getting back to anybody. And what else? Oh, and I drove 100 miles in the wrong direction. Over 100 miles, thank you very much. So, yeah, remember New Mexico? It was a lot like that. Only you weren't here to prevent me from going into the three digits, so fun. I'll tell you about that later. Also, we were talking about your upcoming travels my way. I was looking at the May calendar. Duh. So I'm all confused. Heather and I are going to see Othello July 1st, and we would love for you to accompany us. I don't know when Teen Freedom's event is, though. It's on the list. We could do Shakespeare, Crater Lake, and the coast, if you can make it. If not, we'll just do the coast and Crater Lake. Anyway, let me know, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye. Less than 2 days after she left Travis the voice message on his cell phone, Arius sent him a text message on June 6, 2008, at 9:58 a.m., asking about a check in the amount of $200 dated May 25, 2008, she had mailed him as partial payment for the BMW that he had agreed to sell her. "Hey, I need to know when you're going to deposit that check," she wrote. The following day, June 7th, at 10:21:03, Arius sent an email to Travis in which she related her concern at not hearing back from him in response to her phone call and text message. Subject: from Jody Arius, jodyarius@gmail.com. Date: Saturday, 7 June 2008, 10:21:03. To Travis Alexander, travis.alexander@gmail.com. "Hey, you. I haven't heard back from you. I hope you're not still upset that I didn't come to see you. I just didn't have enough time off. It's okay, sweetie. You're going to be here in less than 2 weeks. We're going to see the sights, check things off the list, and all kinds of fun things. Oregon is beautiful this time of year. Yay! Be happy. Anyway, I wanted to let you know that I'm thinking about pushing my visit up to next week, but it depends on my budget, so I'm not for sure yet. I know you'll be in Cancun, but I'll probably crash at your house in your cozy bed anyway, eat some of your oatmeal and frozen dinners, you know, the usual. JK, smiley face. I know you said the door is always open, but I wanted to give you a heads up. If for any reason that won't work, let me know and I'll make other arrangements. Your home has always been my second home, although it's a bit more lonely without NAPS around. Crooked face. You're probably in California right now, but wherever you are, get a hold of me at least before you head to Mexico. Thanks, hon. Jody. With the discovery of these communications, the Mesa Police Department had now completed their investigation. The end result showed that Arius had been at Travis's house on June 4, 2008, and that they shared a sexual interlude hours before she killed him by stabbing him repeatedly, slashing his throat, and shooting him in the face. She had then attempted to cover up the crime by deleting the photos and staging her communications with him posthumously. With these pieces in hand, I decided to seek a charge of first-degree murder. On July 9, 2008, I presented the case to a Maricopa County grand jury, and that same day the grand jury returned a true bill charging Jody Ann Arius with the first-degree murder of Travis V. Alexander. The proceedings had been conducted in secret as required by law, so Arius had no idea that she had been charged. She wouldn't learn of the charge until she was actually arrested. Ironically, the day the grand jury returned the true bill charging her with murder was her birthday. She was turning 28. Within days of the indictment, police in Mesa called the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office, one of the law enforcement agencies in Northern California that held jurisdiction over Yreka, where Arius lived, and asked them to assist in her arrest. Detective Flores called me on July 14th to let me know that he, his sergeant, and another detective were flying to Yreka to arrest Arius and execute a search warrant on her home. He mentioned that they knew she was living in Yreka but weren't sure of her exact address. The Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office attempted to find Arius's car, a 2004 Infiniti Coupe with a California license plate reading, "To Ascend." It was registered to her parents' address on South Oregon Street in Yreka, but it was nowhere to be found. The deputies ran a computer search and learned that the car had been repossessed by Oregon adjusters at the request of the lien holder on July 9, 2008, and was in a lot in Medford, Oregon, just across the state border. With the car a dead end, investigators turned to searching the Yreka area. They found Arias was employed at a Mexican restaurant called Casa Ramos in Yreka, but they didn't find her there. They explored other leads where she could be, eventually locating her around 9 p.m. on July 14th at the Pine Street home of her maternal grandparents, Caroline and Carlton Sonny Allen. A surveillance unit was sent to that address to monitor her movements, and as it started getting dark, Arias and her mother were seen talking in an animated fashion while they sat in her mother's car parked in front of the home. It appeared they were engaged in an emotional conversation because Arias seemed to be crying. After about an hour, Arias got out of the car and went back inside as her mother drove off. The surveillance team continued their watch rather than attempt a nighttime arrest of Arias. All arrests carry an inherent danger of injury to police, which may include being killed, a risk that increases once it is dark. The better course is to proceed with caution, preferably in the daylight hours when the suspect's movements can be best observed. From their vantage point in the street, the surveillance team was able to see inside the house, where they observed Arias moving around in a northwest bedroom, and it appeared to them she was packing for a trip. They ended the surveillance for the night after the lights in the house went off around midnight. When the officers returned the next morning, July 15th, they noticed that a white Chevy Cobalt rental car was now parked in front of the house. Several packing boxes were in the back seat, some with Jody written on them in black marker. Fearing that Arias might leave town, police decided they needed to move quickly and came up with a plan to arrest her. An officer from the Yreka Police Department, who was also assisting in the investigation, went up to the door under the guise that he was following up on an open burglary report that had been filed by Arias's maternal grandfather almost 2 months earlier on Wednesday, May 28, 2008. In response to a call from Arias's grandfather, phoning to report a burglary, Yreka police had responded to the residence around 3:30 p.m. that May afternoon. When officers arrived, they learned the elderly couple had been out for much of the day and had returned home sometime around 3 p.m. to find that someone had broken into their house by forcing open a side door. That exterior door led to an enclosed patio or porch area, which in turn led to the kitchen. They mentioned that their granddaughter Jody was still at home when they left at approximately 10 that morning. Arias's grandmother Caroline told police she had already called Jody to inform her of the break-in, and Arias showed up at the house shortly thereafter, within 15 minutes. Arias told police that she left home earlier that day at approximately 1 p.m. She also said that the doors and windows were locked before she stepped out. The investigation by police cast doubt on the legitimacy of the burglary. Investigators found it unusual that only one item was taken from each of the house's four rooms. A CD player with cassette and radio was missing from the grandparents' bedroom. Also taken was a DVD player that had been sitting on top of the entertainment center in the living room. Arias indicated that $30 had been stolen from her room, a $20 bill and a $10 bill, both of which had been lying on top of the dresser. Whoever broke in also took a .25 caliber handgun belonging to her grandfather that he kept secured inside a dresser in one of the other bedrooms. This was the same caliber weapon that had been used in Travis's killing. Police noted that other guns stored next to the .25 caliber pistol were left behind. It struck them as strange that items of value were similarly untouched throughout the house. A large amount of change sitting in the dresser where the gun was kept remained undisturbed. It was mostly quarters, which could have been easily carried away. Arias reported that her laptop was undisturbed in the clothes basket underneath some clothing where she left it. She claimed she normally kept the laptop covered up in the basket so that it would not be stolen if there ever were a burglary. When Arias answered the door that Tuesday, July 15th, she had already been notified by co-workers from Casa Ramos that police had called the restaurant and were looking to speak with her, so finding the Yreka officer on her front stoop that morning was probably not a surprise. She was compliant when the officer told her he wanted to get more information about the burglary and asked her to step outside, at which time she was arrested for the first-degree murder of Travis Alexander, arising out of the indictment issued by the Maricopa County Grand Jury less than 1 week earlier. After Arias was driven to the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office, police executed a search warrant on her grandparents' house and the rental car. They began with the bedroom Arias had been using. There they found a number of things that could prove useful, including journals, phones, a personal computer, an external hard drive, and an Airwalk brand shoebox. When police looked inside the shoebox, they found miscellaneous papers and receipts from her June 2nd trip. Police then turned their attention to the rental car parked in front of the house. The boxes in the back seat were mostly filled with clothes and personal items. Police did find two kitchen knives in one of the boxes. In a suitcase, they saw a plethora of condoms. They later recovered a high-point 9mm semi-automatic handgun that had been put in the spare tire compartment in the trunk of the car. The weapon was in a handgun case along with an unloaded magazine. It seemed unusual that a gun and knives would be making another trip with Arias. She did not volunteer any information about where she was headed on her impending trip. Once Arias was taken to the sheriff's office, Detective Flores began his first in-custody interview with her. As he would tell me later that evening when he called, he started out by advising Arias of her Miranda rights and telling her that she did not have to answer questions that made her uncomfortable. Arias responded, "I would love to help you in any way that I can," which was almost exactly what she told Flores on June 10th when she ostensibly called the Mesa Police Department looking to find out what happened to Travis. According to Flores's evening phone call from Yreka briefing me on the interview, he confronted Arias with pointed questions about the DNA results on the bloody latent palm print and the photographs retrieved from the memory card on Travis's camera. He told me Arias remained steadfast in her denial that she had been at Travis's house on the day of the murder, even after he showed her some of the photographs of her posing nude on Travis's bed on June 4th. Arias was booked into the Siskiyou County Jail later that day after her interview with Flores. The white pants and gray top that she was wearing when she was arrested were taken away and replaced by orange jail garb worn by all inmates. During the booking process, as her mugshot was taken, she managed to coquettishly tilt her head to the right and smile for the camera, almost as if she were posing for her high school yearbook. It didn't seem to impress her that she was being booked into jail because she was being accused of killing Travis. Flores called me again the following day on July 16th and told me there was a second interview with Arias, this time with a female detective from the Siskiyou Sheriff's Office. The rationale behind introducing a female voice to the interrogation room was that Arias might be more forthcoming with a woman. But the change in the gender of the person conducting the interview produced the same results. Arias continued to say that she had not been in Mesa and had not hurt Travis. Detective Flores told me that while speaking with the female detective, Arias asked to see him. He said that once he entered the interview room, her story from the day before changed, and she finally admitted that she was at Travis's house on June 4th. But she did not admit killing him and instead told Flores a story of a man and a woman who surprised the two of them as she took pictures of Travis in the shower. Arias claimed that she survived the attack because the assailants were only there to kill Travis. Flores mentioned that Arias even attempted to cast herself in the role of heroine by saying she had fought against the female attacker even though the woman was armed with a knife. According to her revised tale, Travis was alive at the time she made her escape, and shortly before she fled, he had managed to ask her to go get help. When asked if she had called the police, Arias admitted that she had failed to contact anyone, claiming that her cell phone was dead, preventing her from using it. In checking out her story, police visited the rental car company in Redding, California, a city approximately 100 miles south of Yreka, where Arias rented a car for her supposed trip to Utah on June 2nd. The rental car employee, Rafael Colombo, remembered the transaction. When police showed him a photographic lineup composed of 6 photographs of women, which included one of Arias's mugshot and 5 others with similar facial features to hers, he immediately recognized Arias and blurted out that her hair had been blonde when he rented the vehicle to her. Neither Flores nor I really understood the implications of Arias's change in hair color at the time, but it would later become clear that dyeing her hair was part of the plan to enter and leave Arizona undetected. Colombo recalled that when he initially offered her a red car, she declined and asked for one that was lighter in color, with Arias ultimately choosing a white Ford Focus. Not lost on any of the investigators was the fact that Arias drove for approximately an hour and a half to rent a car in Redding, although there were 2 other car rental agencies only minutes away in Yreka. But Yreka is a small town with a population of only about 7,500, so perhaps she figured there was less of a chance she would be recognized at the airport in Redding, where she could blend in as just another customer. Colombo told police that in addition to renting Arias the car, he had also been the one to clean the vehicle after it was returned. He remembered that the floor mats had been missing and that there were stains resembling Kool-Aid on both the back seat and the front passenger seat, leading him to assume that kids had been in the car. He also expressed surprise at the odometer reading, which showed that she had driven over 2,000 miles because she had told him she would only be using the car locally. Arias remained at the Siskiyou County Jail until she was extradited to Phoenix, where she made her initial court appearance on September 6, 2008. Upon arrival at the Maricopa County Jail, she was brought before a commissioner who, based on my recommendation, set her bond at $2 million. 5 days later, Arias appeared for her arraignment and formally entered a plea of not guilty to the first-degree murder charge. The Office of Public Defense Services was appointed to represent her. The first time I saw Jody Ann Arias was at a status conference on October 22nd to discuss the progress of the case. She was sitting in the jury box where she looked out of place. She seemed somewhat small and frail, almost virginal in her black and white horizontally striped jail garb. I took note that a jury might find her sympathetic because of her seemingly unpretentious facade. It was hard for me to see how all that violence could have come from this person. She didn't look like someone who could have committed this type of killing. But then, no one does. Prior to Arias's case, I'd tried 10 death penalty cases in Arizona. Deciding that the death penalty should be sought is not a decision to be taken lightly. If the Maricopa County attorney elects to seek the death penalty, the prosecution must file a notice within 60 days of the arraignment. In this case, I filed such a notice on November 6, 2008, letting defense counsel know that I would be seeking the death penalty should Arias be convicted of first-degree murder. The basis for my request was that the killing was especially cruel. In Arizona, especially cruel describes the infliction of physical or mental anguish upon the victim before death. It also requires that a defendant know or should have known that suffering would occur. The killing in this case was especially cruel because Travis Alexander suffered as he staggered in the bathroom and made his way down the hallway, trying to escape Arias as she carried out her relentless attack. Travis suffered with each stab wound to his back, chest, hands, and head. He didn't die immediately. It was a slow and painful death. Arias' excessive use of force reminded me of another case in which I'd sought the death penalty some years earlier. The victim in that case had been a man by the name of Joseph Andriano, who had been killed in October 2000. The similarities between Joe Andriano's murder and Travis Alexander's were uncanny, even though they were not related. Both murder scenes were bloody, both men were killed by more than one means, and both had been found with gaping wounds to their throats, the result of being sliced with a knife. In the case of Joe Andriano, he had been killed by his wife Wendy, a cute 30-year-old blonde. The two had been married only a few years and had two children when Joe learned that a lump on his neck, once thought to be benign, was malignant and terminal. Wendy saw his misdiagnosis as an opportunity to make money and contacted a lawyer about initiating a medical malpractice suit. She even attempted to obtain a life insurance policy on Joe after she learned he had incurable cancer. She started dating soon after they were told of his cancer and almost immediately fell in love with Rick, a tenant in an apartment complex she managed. The complex was in the Ahwatukee section of Phoenix, and once their relationship started, she let him live in the apartment rent-free. Somehow Rick found out that Wendy's husband was dying, and he was unnerved enough to end their relationship. The breakup did not sit well with Wendy. She would randomly show up unannounced at Rick's apartment, but he still wouldn't take her back. So she hatched a plot to kill her husband. She started the process by creating the fictitious name of Ann Newton, which she used to buy some sodium azide, a propellant for airbags. Sodium azide is not immediately fatal if ingested, but can cause respiratory failure leading to death. Wendy began implementing her plan to kill Joe by emptying some of her husband's medication capsules and refilling them with the poison, intending to give them to him and end his life. Apparently, she could not wait the 6 or so months it would take for his cancer to kill him. On the last night of his life, Wendy took Joe to a barbecue at his parents' house in Casa Grande, a city in Pinal County halfway between Phoenix and Tucson. It was the fourth day of Joe's chemotherapy regimen, and he was not feeling well. Once they returned home after midnight, Wendy gave him the capsules laced with the sodium azide. Wanting to make sure it was enough, she also added sodium azide to the stew that she was warming up for him. The dose wasn't immediately fatal, but Joe started throwing up and asked her to call 911. Moments later, Wendy told Joe she had placed the call, but claimed that emergency responders were too busy to come out. In truth, she hadn't called at all. She later phoned a female friend, Chris, to come over, hoping she would then have a witness to her husband's death. When Chris arrived, Wendy was waiting for her outside the apartment and admitted that she had not called 911. After the two finally entered the apartment, Chris saw Joe lying on the floor, conscious but very ill and literally begging for help. He told Chris that he had been lying there for 45 minutes without any aid. It was then that Wendy went to another room and finally placed the 911 call. Within a few minutes, the sirens could be heard approaching the house. Chris walked outside to meet the fire department, but realized she had left her purse inside. When she tried to re-enter the apartment, she found the front door had been locked, and instead of letting her in, Wendy threw her purse out into the breezeway. When the paramedics knocked on the door, Wendy failed to answer. After approximately 5 to 10 minutes of knocking, one of the paramedics called the dispatcher, who reached Wendy by telephone. The dispatcher convinced Wendy to come out and speak with the paramedics. Rather than coming out the front door, Wendy went out the back, jumped the fence, walked around the apartment building, and met the paramedics in the breezeway outside the locked front door. She informed them that Joe had a DNR, Do Not Resuscitate order, and their services weren't needed. With that information, the Medical Emergency Response Unit left the scene, a protocol that would later be changed. Several hours passed before Wendy again called 911, this time claiming her husband had attacked her after she complied with his dying wish to know if she had been unfaithful. She confessed to him and he attacked her, forcing Wendy to kill him in self-defense. When paramedics finally got inside, they found a bloody scene. Joe had been beaten with a bar stool in excess of 20 times before ultimately being stabbed in the neck with a knife. At the autopsy, it was discovered he had also been poisoned. I prosecuted Wendy Andriano in 2004. After an emotional trial that lasted 3.5 months, she was convicted of first-degree murder. The jury imposed the death penalty, finding the killing to be especially cruel. She was the first woman to be sentenced to death by a jury in the state of Arizona. She has been on women's death row ever since, sharing the distinction with only one other woman. If sentenced to death, Jody Arias would be the third woman on death row in the state of Arizona. Chapter 5. The period of time between the arraignment and trial can be a lengthy one. Following Arias's arraignment, roughly 4 years would pass before the trial actually started. And while that may seem to be dead time with little happening in the courtroom, much work is being completed behind the scenes. This preparation time allows both sides to review documents, interview potential witnesses, and formulate strategies they will employ at trial. It has always been my practice to start the case review as soon as I receive a copy of the police report, which was delivered to me shortly after Arias's arrest. As a prosecutor, I am not a part of the police investigation and rely on periodic updates from the lead detective, in this case Detective Flores, to keep me apprised. While I am alerted to important developments, there are things the investigators do that I am not privy to as they happen. Reading the police reports allows me to see what they have done in their investigation on a day-to-day basis, including the items they have seized, witnesses they have interviewed, and any photographs and other materials they have collected. I always try cases alone, without the assistance of other lawyers, which are normally referred to as second chairs. I favor this single prosecutor approach, although it may mean more work. Because of this, it falls on my shoulders to read every document associated with the case from any source, such as those provided by defense counsel. I sit through every interview of any potential witness, whether or not I believe they are going to be called to testify at trial. I also view every video created at any point of the investigation, including statements made by a defendant to the police. Preparing the case for trial without the assistance of another prosecutor requires that I make decisions regarding which witnesses to call at trial and the order of their appearance. I am solely responsible for the documents, photographs, or other items to be introduced for the jury's consideration. Of course, any cross-examination of witnesses called to testify by defense counsel will likewise be left to me. Opening statements and closing arguments are strictly my province. This approach requires me to be versed in every aspect of the case. In addition to reading the police reports Flores provided me, I began by creating a more detailed portrait of the victim. I learned that Travis was born on July 29, 1977. According to his Arizona driver's license, he was 5 feet 9 inches tall, weighed 180 pounds, and had green eyes. He was one of 8 children, 4 boys and 4 girls. He grew up near Riverside, California, in an area commonly referred to as the Inland Empire. According to a book he was writing about his life called Raising Me, which was posted on the internet, Travis's parents were methamphetamine addicts, and at a young age he went to live with his grandmother, Norma Sarvey, who introduced him to the Mormon faith. He embraced its teachings and attempted to live by church doctrine. After high school, he went on a church mission to Denver, Colorado, and ultimately settled in Mesa, Arizona, because of its strong Mormon community. I looked into Travis's employment at Prepaid Legal Services, which today is called Legal Shield. Travis worked from home, but he was also a motivational speaker for the company and appeared periodically at meetings to help encourage sales of new memberships. Although Travis portrayed himself as financially successful, it seemed that he was struggling to maintain the lifestyle he had built for himself. He had taken in two roommates to help with his mortgage and sometimes borrowed money from an ex-girlfriend to pay his bills. One of the first things I did was check whether Travis Alexander had ever been in trouble with the law, and I found that he hadn't. The only contact he had ever had with police was when he called the Mesa Police Department in February 2008 to report that the tires on his BMW had been slashed while his car was parked outside his house. Although there was only that one call, I learned from Detective Flores's police report that his tires had been slashed on consecutive nights. While all of Travis's friends pointed the finger at Arias, Travis himself vacillated between blaming her and saying he didn't know who had done it. From all that I had read in the police reports, it seemed that Jody Arias had been obsessed with Travis. But, as her interviews with Flores made clear, the irrational nature of her behavior was not reflective of her ability to maintain her composure in the most dire of times. Because Flores had told me that Arias had been so in control during the 2 days of interrogation in Yreka, I needed to look for myself at those interviews to see if she'd made any missteps, however slight. Detective Flores provided me with copies of the videotaped interviews conducted with Arias on July 15th and 16th after her arrest in Yreka. I had a transcript of the tapes prepared, which I checked for accuracy by reading while listening to the actual words being spoken, because it had been my experience that transcriptions always contain mistakes by the transcriber. Even though the transcript is not admissible at trial, I still wanted to make sure it was as accurate as possible so that I could use it in my trial preparation. Closing the door to my office, I turned on the videotape of the July 15th interview on my computer. The first image on the video showed Arias shortly after her arrest, still dressed in white pants and a gray top, resting her head on a small table at the center of the room, her long brown hair falling forward onto the tabletop. She remained in that repose for several minutes, never flinching, to the point where it appeared she was asleep. She then stood up and shook out her arms, and seemingly angry that police had left her in handcuffs, plopped down on the floor with her back to the wall. "Can you take my handcuffs off, please?" were the first words she spoke when Siskiyou Sheriff's Detective Rachel Blaney pushed open the door to check on her. I found it telling that she was so focused on her own comfort when faced with a much bigger issue, that she was in police custody and accused of first-degree murder. Arias appeared irritated when Blaney advised that she'd have to wait for Detective Flores to remove the handcuffs. She lodged her next complaint as soon as Blaney left the room. "It's so fucking cold in here," she mumbled, her shoulders shuddering. The arrival of Flores appeared to mollify Arias, who immediately rose to offer her handcuffed wrists so he could remove the cuffs. Flores's offer of a bottle of water was met with several requests. "Any chance you could get my purse? Any way they can turn the heat up in here? Or, like, do you have a sweater I can borrow or something?" In his relaxed and casual manner, Flores, dressed in a blue button-down shirt and tie, agreed to look into adjusting the temperature and the whereabouts of her purse, which had been taken during her arrest. "So you remember me?" Flores asked once she had finished her litany of requests. "Of course I do," Arias acknowledged. "I traveled all the way up here to come talk to you because, you know, I've been working on Travis's case ever since it happened. And I know exactly when it happened, when he was killed. I know a lot of details, and just recently we found quite a bit of evidence, and I'll discuss that with you. The main thing that I'm looking for, though, is answers on why certain things happened and why they went so far, and also to get your statements. A lot of details on this case that haven't been released to the public, and not even to Travis's family. And those details are known only by us and the person who did it, okay? And that's one of the reasons I'm here, is because I believe that you know some of those details. And I think you can help us."
"I would love to help you in any way that I can," Arias responded, leaning in toward the detective, her pale, thin arms crossed at the elbows, stretched on the table. She appeared to be listening as Flores read her the Miranda rights and set out the purpose of the interview.
What I'm going to do is just ask some questions, ask you what you've been doing, kind of clarify some things.
As I watched this interview, what struck me most was Arias's ability to be so controlled and devoid of emotion right from the start. Most people get extremely apprehensive just being stopped by police for a traffic infraction. Yet Arias demonstrated no reaction as her Miranda rights were read and she was advised, amongst other things, that she had the right to remain silent. But as I was going to see, remaining silent was not something she would ever do.
"Is this recorded at all?" she asked, looking behind her. "Or should we, I mean?"
Before the detective could respond, she reached behind her to retrieve two tape recorders from a small wooden table in the corner of the room, placing them on the table in front of Flores.
"I don't know if these are voice recorders. I noticed them. If they have video cam, or they have audio, or batteries, or what?"
Arias was so aware of her surroundings that she noticed two small recorders lying on the table in the corner behind her. I took note of her acumen and concluded that she would probably never lose her composure, whether it be in an interview room or a courtroom. Flores lifted the recorders and looked at them as if to be checking their status.
"I don't think they are on," he assured her.
To which Arias again complained of being cold and reminded the detective that she had asked that the heat be turned up. Flores sidestepped the temperature issue, bringing the conversation back around to the homicide.
"What have you been up to since Travis's death? What have you been doing?"
Well, I've been working," Arias said. "I haven't been really working for prepaid legal. There's not a whole lot here in this marketplace."
"It's kind of small here."
"It's small here, and really that could be seen as an opportunity rather than a hindrance, because that just means the market is untapped in a large way, so I could have it if I wanted to. But I'm kind of like a deer in the headlights when it comes to prepaid legal, and I just have a fear of approaching people. So I've been working in a Mexican restaurant on the north end of town. I've been in kind of a daze. At least for the first few weeks."
"Like everybody you know," Flores concurred, obviously trying to keep her talking.
Without prompting, Arias turned the conversation to the online tributes and news coverage surrounding Travis's death.
"I know that a lot of people have been posting on Facebook really nice things and memories, and at one point I was like, well, maybe I should do that. So I posted this thing and I just said all of my memories, and I realized, looking back on it, that it kind of sounded immature. It's more like my Dear Travis kind of letter. And so I took it down because..."
Arias was referring to her June 14th comment posted on the internet site called Guestbook.
"Travis, what can I say to you that I haven't already said? I am so grateful for the endless hours of conversation and amazing experiences we've shared.